actually, it's not new, it's a couple years old, but it's not what I talked about yesterday. How to prove hardcore predicates using list decoding approach. And I will, in the next slide, define what hardcore predicates are and what using list decoding approach and so forth. And this is joint work with Adi Akavya, who's a graduate student in Muli Safra. And I think Adi will be here actually in a workshop next week that you're having. And she's also finishing this year. She's great. Okay, so let's just define, start slowly. And I want to define what hardcore predicates are. And in order to define what hardcore predicates are, just remind you what one-way functions are. So one-way function is a function f, which is polynomial time to compute, and not in polynomial time to invert. And not only that it's, I can't invert f of x for every x, but in fact it should be sort of hard on the average. So it's hard to invert on a non-negligible fraction of x. So for most f of x's, it's impossible to invert. And again, when I say non-negligible, everything, that means smaller than any one of a polynomial. So the x's are growing. So you think of this as an asymptotic definition. Now, so this is the definition of one-way function. Again, just think about it. Easy to compute, hard to invert, almost everywhere. And we don't know if they exist. If they did exist, if we could prove that, we could resolve the P versus NP question and lots of other questions. But we have some candidates. And what are the candidates? So let's just think sort of in our mind, so the three candidates, you know, the exponentiation candidate, G to the X mod P, or the RSA candidate, X to the E mod N, where N is a composite modulus and P is a prime. Or let's say a third function that you could sort of keep in the back of your mind is the elliptic curve function, where I have some point of high order on an elliptic curve. And what I'm doing is, when I evaluate this function on x, I take x multiples of this point to get another point. So it turns out that to add points is easy, or over here it's multiplying points. That's the polynomial time computation, multiplying q by x. However, given the result, so giving a second point, p, and given q, finding which x you need to multiply q by in order to get to p, again, that's a computation which is hard. Hard in the sense that we don't have good algorithms. The best algorithms that exist are sub-exponential. And when I say sub-exponential, I mean in the length of p or the length of n, or here in the length of p again, because you're working in some sort of finite field. Let's say in f of p. Okay, so these are one-way functions, and why am I giving you these candidates? Because it will be relevant to what I want my point is going to be here. The point is that even though we believe, at least there is some belief that these functions are hard to invert, inherently hard to invert, we also know that from looking at g to the x mod p, say, there are some things about x which are easy to compute. I don't know how to recover all of x, but I do know how to compute some things about x. So for example, from g to the x mod p, I can tell whether x is even or odd. That's a very easy computation. I think that was discovered by Lipton in the context of some protocol that Tamir Vesnadelman proposed for poker, for mental poker, and he showed how to cheat. And cheating amounted to the fact that he showed that from g to the x mod p, you can actually tell whether x is even or odd. So if you think about x as the card and g to the x mod p as sort of encrypting the card, you might not know which card it was, but you would know if it's a high or low card because x was even or odd. Okay, so we know that. We also know that that not all of x is easy to compute, right? Otherwise, it wouldn't be one way. And this notion of hardcore predicate, which was initiated by Blum and Micali, and then it's the following. So this is the definition. We say that a predicate P, okay, is hardcore for f. So we think f is a one-way function. We say that p is hardcore for f. This is, really goes back to 82, this definition. And we're saying that given f of x, computing this p of x, so if you think about given g to the x mod p, computing the least significant bit of x was easy. But computing, say, the most significant bit of x, turns out that if you could do that better than half 50-50 plus epsilon, then you could actually invert f. So it's as hard. The problem of actually getting that bit better than 50-50 is as hard as inverting the function altogether. Okay. And examples are the most significant bit of x for g to the x mod p, which I will call, because I'll use it in this talk, I'll call this half bit. So even though these are very, very old problems, you know, more than 20 years old, we have something new to say about them. And another example is that for RSA, say x to the e mod n, then the, let's say, the least significant bit of x is hard to guess better than 50-50. That's true also for the most significant bit. In fact, it's true for every bit. True in what sense? In the sense that I can prove that can be proved this statement. Okay, so that if you could predict this bit better than 50-50, you could invert to the X mod P. And if you could compute this bit better than 50-50, you could invert the RSA function. Okay, now that's just the generalization of it, which starts to get me into this Lissacone approach, by Goldrush and Levin. So by generalization, I mean what they consider the following question. They say, okay, so for RSA, there's a certain bit. For a discrete log, there's another. For G to the X mod P, there's another bit. How about if somebody just tells you F is a one-way function, but you don't know anything about the algebraic properties of this function, the whether you know it's multiplicative or whatever. You know nothing about it, just that it's one way. So they said, can you show that every one-way function has a hardcore predicate? There's something about, you know, if you look at f of x, there's something about x which is sort of hard, the hardest. And they show, yes, that's the case. And what is the predicate? So what they're saying is the following. Let f be any one-way function. Then they define this, I call the Goldrush-Levin predicate, which GLXR, so you think about R as the length of R of x, and the Goldrush-Levin predicate is essentially just the inner product of x and R. Okay, so what have I done here? I took the original function f, and now I said, you know what, let's in some sense extend its domain. Instead of talking about x, I'm talking about a pair as x and r, and I can think about a new function, f prime. This new function is just f of x concatenated with r. Okay, if f of x was one way, also this function is one way, right? Why is that? Because this function r is totally in the clear, but x is still hard to find. Okay, so the new function f prime is still one way. Moreover, what they're claiming is that this predicate is a hardcore predicate. So if you could guess this inner product of x and r, okay, better than 50-50, you could invert this entire function. You could recover x. Okay? All right. In some sense, the intuition is that what is the inner product of x and r? That's like saying, okay, somebody gives me f of x, okay? And now I tell him, here, give me the a random subset, somewhat two of a random subset of the bits of x. That's what this predicate corresponds to. So, or because R, what is R specifying? R is specifying which, you know, if I give a certain R, specifies which bits of X to zero out, which bits of X not to zero out, sum them out too. Okay. In any case, so this is a hardcore predicate for any one-way function.
Do you have some condition on R that makes it small?
Yeah, I didn't write it here. R is the same length of X, I said.
Well, that's all. It could be equal to
length of X. It is the same length of X. That's what I said. So when I
no,
I have no condition.
So it could be ones all the way.
It could be ones all the way, but my statement is probabilistic. I'm saying if you have an algorithm, if you have a predictor who can predict this value of this inner product better than half plus epsilon, where the probability is taken over the x's and the r's, then I can invert the function. So if you think about it, if I fix an x, okay, and I just vary the r's, still there'll be if I have a predictor that works over the x's and r's, okay. So I have a predictor that if I enumerate or go through all the x's and r's, it predicts the inner product of xr better than half plus epsilon. Now if I just fix x, just by counting, and I vary over the r's, there's still some non-negligible number of x's for which you will have an advantage of a half plus epsilon over 2. Okay. So I think you're ahead of... So hopefully I am guessing what you're thinking. Anyway, so there's great relevance actually to crypto for these bits, these hardcore bits. Why? Because essentially, yeah.
Is it a hard theorem?
that's a very, you know, every theorem is easy in some sense because it's true. But what do you say? What do you mean?
I find it surprising.
Yeah, it's not true. It's there's some work to do, definitely. And in fact, that's the kind of our starting point, and I'll explain how it's done. Okay, in a minute I'll show you how this proof is done. Because that proof is done by this Lissacone approach, which I want to use for other things. This is exactly where...
Okay.
No, it is...
Okay.
Okay, good. So I didn't flash it up. This is actually something I want the proof of. Okay, so anyway, it has use for serial number generation, for encryption, for commitment protocols. Let's get to the proof, okay? How does this proof look like, okay? So this proof... how does this proof look like? Okay, in general, how do these proofs look like first, before we get to the Goldrush-Levin proof, okay? So if we think about the G to the X mod P and showing that the most significant bit of X is as hard as inverting You could ask that question as well. How about for that theorem? So how would you prove that? If you go from G to the X mod P, okay, there's some magic box, and it will tell you whether X is less than P minus 1 over 2 or not. And this magic box is correct half the time plus a little bit more. Okay? Then I claim that I could start with G to the X mod P, okay, somehow now I'm given a particular G to the Z mod P. And I want to find out what Z is. I can use this box, essentially call it many times, a polynomial number of times, and at the end I will recover what Z is. So how would a proof like that work? So these proofs usually work like this. By a reduction. The reduction is the following. Whoops. This animation. Better than yesterday. I demade this animation. So by reduction. So suppose you have this magic box, as I drew on the board there, that from f of z predicts the value of the predicate better than 50 plus epsilon, then we'll show an inverting algorithm from f of x to x. So you have to show some kind of reduction. And in fact, if you look at all these proofs for the discrete log, for RSA, for the elliptic curve case, each proof is different than each other. You know, essentially it uses a particular function, uses some sort of sampling techniques, and using somehow appropriate techniques, you are able to show these results. Okay? Now, the Goldreich-Levin proof is different. Okay, so it's not working with a specific function, so you can't really assume anything about the properties of the function. Okay? So there has to be, in some sense, something different going on. Okay, so let me show you how this proof works. So I'll just get the animation and let's get to it. The idea is the following, that they have. What they did is, and in fact, this paper by Goldreich-Levin, even though the intent of it was to talk about hardcore predicates, is the first paper that has a list decoding algorithm, which is polynomial time, and it really starts the whole list decoding. There's a lot of work now on coming up with list decoding algorithms for known codes or designing new codes that have good list decoding algorithms. This is really the first list decoding algorithm which works in polynomial time is here. Okay. So what did they do? And what does list decoding have to do with it? Okay, again, there we are talking about f of x concatenated with r, and somebody tells me that they have a magic box that will tell what the inner product is, the sum of xi ri mod 2, okay, better than half plus epsilon. And somehow I want to use this magic box in order to recover x. Okay? So they claim that this kind of box can always be used to recover x. This is how their proof works. They say, step one, let's define a code. So we are making a jump to somewhere else. First we're talking about one-way functions, now we're talking about codes. Okay? So they say, let's define a code, and we call it, in their case, the code that they defined is the Hadamard code. So by the Hadamard code, I mean that if the encoding of x, so Hadamard sub x, I mean the encoding of x at location j, so the notation I'm going to use, is essentially the inner product of x with j. Okay, so if you think about the encoding of x then, so x, you know, gets mapped to this vector. Okay, well over here you have the inner product of x with 1, inner product of x with 2, and so forth. And how many locations you have? You have 0, 1, to the n. Okay, where n is the length of x here. So you're just going through all these possible vectors of r's, all the possible r's, and each r corresponds to a different location in the code. So it's a binary code, right? There's either 0, 1 here, which is the value of the inner product, then you're starting with r being all zeros, zeros followed by 1, and so forth. Okay, so this is a well-known code. And then what they did, the second step of the proof is to say, this code is accessible. What do I mean by that? I mean the following. I mean the given f of x and r, okay, given f of x and r, and a magic box, okay, which is able to do these kind of things, okay, to do the prediction better than half of epsilon, is the same. You can think of that as someone giving you access, okay, to a corrupted version of this code word, random access to a corrupted version of this code word. So in other words, look at this code word, okay, and let's just think about it being corrupted now. Corrupted, so it went through some channel, if we think about coding theory terminology, and some of the bits got flipped. Okay? How many? Let's say not less than half of the bits, half minus epsilon of the bits got flipped. Okay? So that means that this new thing, how much does it agree with the old thing? By half plus epsilon. Right? So less than a half of these are corrupted, so more than a half of these are okay. Yes? So if you think about encoding theory, I can think of this as a corrupted word, which is essentially half plus epsilon okay, then what I, in terms of one-way functions and predicates, I'm saying, you know what, actually I can think of this magic box as if what it's doing for me is it's telling me what is the value of the code word at location R, but it's not always correct, but it's more than half of epsilon correct. Okay, so there are two worlds here. On one hand, there is the function and the predicate, and I'm saying now I can think of it as a coding problem. Okay, where this inner product thing describes the Hadamard code, and the access to the magic box describes access to a corrupted code word. Okay? All right. And then finally, what so far we're just sort of saying that we're saying that we want to sort of think a different way. We want to think that what we have is a code and a way to access a corrupted code word. Okay, the Hadamard, let's say location J. Now, what Goldhagen Levin had to prove, which is the non-trivial step, is to show that this code is list decodable. Okay, by list decodable, I mean that, in fact, if you are given access to a corrupted code word, where it's corrupted to this extent, less than half minus epsilon, then they're able to recover the X, but they can recover it uniquely. So what they're claiming is, for Hadamard code, it is the case that as long as there's less than a half errors, okay, then you can... it's recoverable. But it's not uniquely recoverable. They will come up with a list of x's. It could be x1, x2, x3, x2, 100. And x is one of those 100 candidates. And the length of the list is polynomial. That's what we mean by list decodable. That you can decode, you cannot uniquely decode, you will get a list, and the size of the list is polynomial. So going back to one-way functions, this means, okay, that if given that they can achieve this third bullet, that they have actually proved, this is a proof I claim, so let's go through it. This is a proof that this inner product is a hardcore predicate for S. Why? Because there is actually a reduction here. Essentially by using this algorithm, this list decoding algorithm, what this list decoding algorithm does is it takes this magic box, okay? And every time it needs to access a corrupted code word, it looks at what the magic box is doing. And then runs this algorithm and gets a list of X's. Okay? Now, list of x is not good enough. I really want to invert f of x and find the exact x. But you know what? I have f of x in my hand, and I have a list of x's, x of 100. So what I'll do is I'll check whether f xi is equal to f of x. I'll just check. Okay? And as soon as it is equal to it, I found an inverse. Yes? Okay, so whether we exactly sort of follow each step, first of all, other questions? Okay, nice theorem. Essentially, the main part is, you know, the mind switch to connect it to hardcore predicates, but the mathematical challenge is to show this list decoding. So following this paper in Paliazzo in Sudan, I think an independent work, they said, well, maybe this is actually a general approach, okay, for proving that if you give me a one-way function and a predicate, that the predicates are hardcore. So you can sort of forget what I showed you in the last slide because of too much detail. Here is kind of an abstraction of it. Okay? So what they're saying, you know what, maybe there's a general approach here. Maybe what we could do is, let's write it this way. Maybe if you have some one-way function and somebody says, I think, you know, the most significant bit is a hardcore or some predicate is hardcore. Maybe the way to prove it is not to start looking at the guts of the function and the algebraic properties and so forth, but maybe what has to be done is, what you could do is always start out with defining some kind of code. What code? Who knows? That would depend on the predicate. In the case of Goldhagen Levin, it was the Hadamard code. It was sort of obvious. That's the code that they're defining. But more generally, I'm saying maybe there's always a way to define some error-correcting code, then to show accessibility, to show that in some sense, given f of x and giving a predicting box is the same as having access to a corrupted code word for x. Okay, so in some sense, abstractly, that's all that happens. Given f of x and a predicting box, somehow I'm showing you that's the same as having access to a corrupted code word with respect to this code that was defined. And the third step is, and then also show that this code is, you know, in a wish list was defined, okay, then also show that code is list decodable, then it would be done. This would be a proof that predicate is hardcore. because just like we did before, we run the list decoding algorithm using the predictor box for access to the corrupted code word. We get a list of candidates. One of the members of the list is the original x, you know, x from our input f of x. That's a way to go from f of x to x. So by the way, that's by itself already very nice. Okay, we can end here. But the point is that this was a wish list. So they said, wouldn't it be nice if we could actually use this list decoding approach? But there was no example of it except for the Goldreich-Levin example. So it would be it's very elegant, however, not necessarily useful. So what we do here,
reading your P is hardcore for F standard identity, not for X, right? For F, comma I.
That's, you mean, you're talking about Goldreich-Levin?
Yeah.
Okay, so good point, good place to say that. So, because you're right, in some sense, the Goldreich-Levin, what they did is they have this randomized predicate, where the R is sort of the random part. Whereas here the suggestion is maybe this is a good strategy even when there is no R. Maybe this is a good strategy just for the regular, you know, you've given a one-way function F, you've given the predicate P, and you don't want to change F now. So you think now that my wish is to actually use RSA, okay, and to talk about the predicate which is the least significant bit. Can I get a proof that the least significant bit is hardcore for RSA using this approach? We already know it. I just want a different proof now. Okay? Yes? So there's no R. In that example, there was R. Here, there isn't. Okay. And in fact, that's what we'll do today. So we will show, essentially, how to use this kind of list decoding approach to prove hardcore predicates for a large family of predicates, which are deterministic. So we don't have the concatenation with R thing, and for various one-way functions. And this essentially is both essentially reproving old results in a different way, but you also get some new hardcore predicates, the whole collection of new hardcore predicates. Okay? So in some sense, what's nice about it is that it's a unifying proof. You have the same proof regardless of which one-way function you're talking about and which predicate. And we will see how that goes. And just staying ahead, really what we will do is what I tried to abstract out, and that is we will show you how we will define a predicate, which will encompass actually all the predicates we used to know, and we will show how to define an error-correcting code corresponding to this predicate. Then we will show why predicting a predicate is the same as accessing a corrupted code word. And then for those codes that we define, we go backwards. We'll show a list decoding algorithm, which in turn will imply a proof. All right, so if I just write something on the board, I would write this. I must say, the Fields Institute is excellent. I haven't found any bug here, you know, in terms of the board, the offices, the computer program. But taking down the board is the only place where it's hard. Where's the... Okay. Okay, never mind. So up here. So in some sense, I want, starting with a predicate, come up with an error-correcting code such that a magic box that predicts the predicate is the same as access to a corrupted code word. Okay? And then I will, so it's a translation from the hardcore predicates to coding. Then in the coding world, I have to devise a list decoding algorithm. So some algorithm that decodes the corrupted code word and gives me a list of candidates. And from here, I go back and sort of invert F. So that means that if I was able to do these three steps, I get a proof that shows me that the existence of a magic box implies inversion of F. And therefore, the predicate is hardcore. Okay, so let's do that. And yeah.
The number theoretical predicates are
included. Yes. So you'll see. So let me define what my predicate is. It's going to define one family of predicates, and it will actually include all the number theoretical predicates. So here's what I call we call them segment predicates. And balance here just means that it's half the time 0 and half the time 1. But we can also talk about unbalanced predicates at the end that maybe I'll mention. And we say that Pn is a basic segment predicate if, essentially, the requirement of being basic means that if you look at how many times it changes from 0 to 1 on the line of going from 1 to n, okay, then there's a polynomial number of switches. So here it's 0, then it's 1, 0, 1, but there's only polynomial number of switching over. So if it was, let's say, twice, okay, then that's polynomial, yes, but any polynomial. So what's an example here? I think that's... In a minute, I'll give an example. So that's a basic segment predicate. A segment predicate is defined to be if there exists, Pn is a segment predicate, if there exists an A and a basic segment predicate, Pn prime, such that you could express this segment predicate as the basic one of X over A. For where Pn prime is a basic segment predicate and A is relatively prime with big N. Okay, so what shall we retain from here? So whereas before, in the Goldrush Levin, really, the predicates went from... went from a cross product of whatever X, the domain of X, and the random, right? Here my predicate is going from Zn to 0, 1. So still a 0, 1 predicate, right, going from defined over Zn. And a basic one means that you have only a polynomial number of switching. A non-basic means that there exists a basic one and an A, where A is relatively prime with N. You don't really necessarily have to remember it because I'll remind you, but you can express P of X as P prime of X over A. Okay? And it's all mod N. All the arithmetic here is mod N. Okay, so what are some examples? Let's look at an example of what's a segment predicate. So I claim that, and forget the one-way functions. We're just talking about predicates on X, okay? So whether if X is less than n over 2 or greater than n over 2, that's a basic segment predicate. Because essentially all the X's up to half, it's 0 and then it's 1. So there's a one-point switch over, right? And how about whether X is even or odd? Okay, so that's not basic because we're switching every time. So there's certainly more than a polynomial number of switching, but I claim it's a segment predicate. Why? Because I could define it, essentially, when n is odd, at least, I can define it in terms of a basic segment predicate. So I'm saying that the value of the least significant bit of x mod n is the same as whether x over 2 is less than or greater than n over 2. Okay, why do I care that n is odd? Because I'm dividing by 2 here. That's that A. So to have 2 relatively prime with... So I need 2 to be the relatively prime with n. And if n were even, it wouldn't be.
Is there any significance to the fact that you're dividing by A rather than multiplying by A?
No. It's only...
But then you wouldn't need the GCD condition.
No. What, is there any significance? I mean, I could define this possibly differently, but it wouldn't be X times A. So the GCD condition is important, okay? Because in particular, if it wasn't there, I would prove something which was false. For example, if you think about g to the x mod p, okay, so the function g to, so you think about n being p minus 1, because you're looking at the x's, and the x range from 1 to p minus 1, so p minus 1 is even, okay? If this would be true even for an n that's even, I would be able to prove that the least significant bit of x with respect to g to the x mod p is a hard bit, and I know it's not a hard bit, I know how to compute it. So maybe I could define it so there's only multiplication operations, but it wouldn't be x times a, okay? So just to give you a feeling, why is this true? I mean, it doesn't really matter for the key points of the talk, but if you think about it, if you have, if x is even, okay, so if we have an even x, then when I divide it by 2, then what do I get? I get something that's going to be less than n over 2. So regardless of where I am, if the thing is even, then it means that x over 2 is over here. But if the thing is odd, okay, then dividing by 2 is really multiplying by 2 inverse mod n, that would map me actually over here. That's the relationship between being even and odd versus greater or less than n over 2. Okay, never mind. And there are more. So these are actually predicates we knew about. Here are some new predicates, okay, that fit within the definition of segment predicates, but people haven't bothered to try to prove that they are hardcore predicates. So there are many predicates that satisfy this definition which people haven't necessarily tried to prove before. Maybe it would have been easy, maybe it would have been hard, I have no idea, but they're covered by this proof. Okay, so let's see how this works. So I said that first thing we need to do for this, now I have to show you the segment predicates are hardcore. So I'll give you a new proof, okay? And the first step is to define a code, right? We said that that would be the next step. Not here. Ah, define the code. Yeah, define the code. Okay. So what is the code? This is the code. We call it the multiplication code. So the multiplication code is defined to be as follows. So I'm trying to encode x, okay? And I'm saying the code word corresponding to x in the jth location, I want to define it in this implicit way because I'm always going to sort of implicitly access the locations in the code word, okay? So first of all, the way I'm indexing the code word is, so again, let's think of sort of a vector, okay? And I'm in this, j here is in zn, okay? And essentially what I'm saying is the way you're going to express x is that in the first location, you're going to write n. In the first location, you're going to essentially take j equal to 1 x mod n, okay? In the second location, so here I'm going to write x mod x, the predicate defined on x mod n. And here it will be the predicate defined on 2 x mod n, and so forth. Okay, so in other words, I'm saying I want to encode my x using the predicate, okay? So the predicate on what? I'm saying the predicate on 1 times x mod n, the predicate on 2x mod n, on 3x mod n, on 4x mod n, taking all the multiples of x, taking the predicate on the first location, second location, third location, I write that binary description now, and saying that's my new encoding of x. So note, this is not, you know, I've expanded. Yes, my x was length of n, right? So if the modulus is big n, then the x is just an element of log n size, okay? Now the encoding is exponential size. But I'm not really proposing this for sending information in the internet. I'm coming up with a proof, right? So all I care about is that I can actually access locations in this code word. And with enough access, I will be able to recover x. I don't have to actually write down the entire code word. Although, so I, even though the purpose of all of this work was to, you know, get a proof, actually Adia did some future follow-up work where she uses these ideas to propose a code that would be used for communication. And again, the idea won't be that you will send an exponential length description, but you will send some sort of random subset of it, and it would be good enough to be able to decode the original code word. But anyway, let's continue with this work. So here, let's do an example. So if my predicate was the half predicate, being less than or greater than n over 2. So in this slide, n is just p minus 1. In general, I'm going to use n because it will take different values depending on the one-way function. And what we're talking about is whether, you know, a particular x is less than p minus 1 over 2, so it's over here in this half circle, or it's greater than p minus 1 over 2. So it's in this half circle. And I'm saying, how would I be able to encode x, a particular x, okay, with respect to this predicate? And the answer is, essentially, if you think about the code word, then everywhere up to p minus 1 over 2, it's always a 0, right? Because essentially, the bit here would correspond to whether x is less than p minus 1 over 2, then whether 2x is less than p minus 1 over 2, 3x is p minus 1 over 2, and so forth. So when x is small, okay. Did I say too much, maybe? Possibly. Okay. So that's what the code word of 1. So this c sub 1 means that I'm coding the value 1. The encoding of the value 1 looks like this. It's 0 is half the way, and then 1. And then coding of the value 2, say, okay, looks like this. So if you multiply 2 by all these small numbers, it's still a small number, so still less than p minus 1 over 2. Then you multiply it by bigger numbers, switches over to be greater than p minus 1 over 2, and again, because of the wraparound. Okay. You know, and such nice pictures, we do it again. Okay. All right, so what is the theorem then? Okay, so the theorem is the following. Then we'll give an idea of how we get it. So the theorem is this. If you have a segment predicate, so a predicate is defined the way I define it, so either basic or sort of not basic, then, and you define the code as I just defined it, so it's the predicate at jx mod n, okay, then first I claim that this code is accessible. with respect to RSA, exponentiation, elliptic curve. What do I mean by accessible? What I mean is that I'll show that's easy to show is that actually if you gave me a magic box that predicts P better than 50-50, it's the same as giving me access to a corrupted, random access to a corrupted code word for this code. Okay. So in other words, I have to show you how why is that true. In a second, we'll do that. Then I have to show that this code is list decodable. This will be harder. And as a conclusion, so this is very easy to show, and this is harder. Okay, so I'm claiming that for this code, those two things are true, and then the next theorem will say is when you have these two properties, okay, then, you know, P is a hardcore predicate. Which in some sense you should already believe, because we already went through this routine of essentially running the list decoding algorithm, using the axis, and then inverting the function. So then we would get our corollary, that in fact the segment predicate is a hardcore for RSA, exponentiation, and elliptic curve. So let me first talk about the first bullet. Okay, so the first bullet says this. It talks about this accessibility, and maybe by looking at it concretely it will become sort of more clear what I want. I need to show you it's accessible. So I need to show you that if I only have f of x, and I also have a magic box for the predicate, somehow I can access a corrupted code word. Okay? Okay, so recall, how is this code defined? The jth location is just j times x mod n, and take the predicate. Okay. So in the yellow box up there, I'm saying, look, this is given to me. I'm given this magic box. It is able on f of z, okay, to do this predicate prediction. Okay. How can we now look at it differently to think of this box as giving me access to the code word? I say, well, look, this box works this way. I am given in the yellow box an f of x. All I need to do is somehow to be able to supply the magic box with f of x times j. Okay? Because the magic box, what it gives me out is the predicate at xj mod n, which is exactly the code word at location j. So somehow I have to show you how, starting with f of x, I'm a n and j, okay, because I'm interested in the jth location of the code of x. How can I come up with f of xj? Because once I did that, I'm done. Because my magic box will give me the predicate at xj, which is exactly, you know, the jth location of the code word of x. Okay. So the key thing that I need to do now is to be able to show you how to go from f of x and j, how to provide the box with the right input, so that it will be able to spit out, you know, the code word at location j. Now notice, of course, the box was going to make mistakes. You know, if the box was 100% correct, then my picture would be true. But the box actually is only half plus epsilon correct. So sometimes it doesn't give the right predicate. So this thing is corrupted. But I do know that at least half plus epsilon of the times that it answers, the answer is right. Okay, so how do I come up with this f of xj then? So for RSA, it's extremely simple. Essentially, if somebody gives me RSA of x, the way that I get RSA of j times x is just RSA of x times j to the exponent of RSA mod n, and that the result is x. So it's the encryption of x and times the encryption of j. So this is very simple. Notice here that what's little n respect to big n? I'm sort of defining everything with respect to big n, but if you look at a particular case, big n here is little n. There's a little cheat here, but it doesn't matter. Because we're looking at Zn star, really, but the point is that most of the elements in Zn star really covers enough of Z of n, at least sub little n. Questions? Okay. What about g to the x mod p? So exponentiation. Again, if I need to find exponentiation of g times x, and I'm given only g to the x, but that's okay. I just take it to the power j. And again, what I get is g to the x times j. So I have been able to, again, provide the box with the right input, which would be e to the j, g to the j x mod p. So over here I'm working on p minus 1. So my capital big N is p minus 1 here. And for elliptic curves, similarly, in order to get the multiple, the jx multiple of a point, if I only have the x multiple of a point, I just multiply by j. Okay, so accessibility is easy. And again, the big value of n is different in these three examples. But I'm going to point out that this is the last time you'll see these one-way functions. So the rest of the proof doesn't really care which one-way function we're worrying about. The only part of the proof that cares about which one-way function you're trying to prove something hardcore predicate for is here, to show how you can go from f of x to f of x times j. Okay, so what's the next step? So to show that this new code is less decodable is the bulk of the work. Just like in the Goldrath-Levy, really, the bulk of the work is to show the Hadamard code is less decodable. We need to do that here. Okay, for this new multiplication code. Okay. So we do this using Fourier analysis over Zn. And without getting, right now, in a minute we will, but right now the useful property I need is the following. Let's think of the black graph to correspond to the code word of x, okay? And what's going to be true is that if I look at essentially the Fourier characters, okay, and this is the weight that Px has on them, then I look at a corrupted version of it, then the following is going to be true. That regardless of which corruption it is, as long as the corruption agrees more than half plus epsilon, then if you look at these two functions, they will have, both of them will have some the weight of the Fourier coefficient for some location, okay, will be high. Okay, so if I look at all the Fourier coefficients which are sort of have some reasonable weight for Cx, and all the Fourier coefficients which have some reasonable weight for the corrupted code word, okay, then there's going to be one that is in common between the two of them. Okay. Okay. And two, that if somebody gives me a Fourier coefficient, which is heavy, then I actually can find all the x's, okay, such that that coefficient is the heavy Fourier coefficient of C sub x. So I've made a mind switch here, which I will actually give all the details in the next slide, where I'm thinking about it, the code word as a function. And I'm talking about Fourier analysis of this function. So I'm thinking about C sub x, not as just a string of bits, but really the function from location to the value of the bit in that location. And if I think of that function, I could look at its Fourier representation. I could look at what characters are heavy and what aren't, have heavy weight and don't. And I'm saying there will be at least one heavy weight character in common between the code word and its corrupted version. And not only that, but if you give me that location, I can find all the x's for which this is a heavy Fourier coefficient. Has a heavy Fourier coefficient. And then I claim, then we would be done. If you believe these points, even abstractly, without understanding exactly the definition of a Fourier coefficient, then you could see that I have a list decoding algorithm. Why? How would the list decoding algorithm sort of work? Okay, so let's see. Sorry, so I thought I had a slide there. The way it will work, which we'll later repeat, is that first, given a corrupted code word, okay, you'll think of it as a function, and what you want to do is try to find out all the heavy Fourier coefficients of this function. How? We need to answer the question. But say we had a way to do it. So given a function, we knew how to find all the heavy Fourier coefficients of this function. Then we say, okay, let's look at all these heavy ones. I know that one of them is actually also heavy for the Fourier representation of Cx, okay? But I don't know which Cx. So I use this recovery bit, and I find a list of all possible x's for which this is a heavy Fourier coefficient. My x, the original one, is on that list. Okay. All right, so this is just sort of a vague plan. Okay, I claim that this vague plan has all the main algorithmic ideas that we're going to need, but we need to implement them. So we need to show a bit more. So the main tool, first of all, is how I sort of implicitly said that if I had a function, or the, you know, or a function I'm thinking about is the location to the bit value, okay, if I had this function, I could find all the heavy Fourier coefficient of this function. Who says? So what you need for this is a learning algorithm, in fact, which is the main tool here. So what's the input to this algorithm? The input to this algorithm is somehow you have a function over Zn, and I don't need the whole function table, but I have a way, you know, so it's really W, the corrupted codeword is this function. Right, so it's a function from J to the location. Sorry, to the value 0, 1 in the location. And I'm saying, if you give me implicit access to such function, okay, implicit access meaning I've supplied J, you give me the bit value, and you give me some threshold, tau, then I will output for you a short list containing the Fourier characters of this function of weight at least tau. Okay, and the complexity of this algorithm will be polynomial in log big N and 1 over tau. Now, there's some related work to this. First of all, this whole approach of analyzing, you know, given a function, finding the heavy Fourier coefficient, is first done by Kushlevitz and Mansour in 91 within the context of learning theory. Okay, and what their work is restricted is to functions over 0, 1 to the N. So whereas we're talking about functions that are defined, my W here goes from Zn to 0, 1, the integers mod n to 0, 1. In their case, these were the function was defined over binary vectors. Then there was work by, which actually we were not aware of, but Indic, many people here, which actually do the same task over Zn, which is what we need. Okay, so we have a different algorithm, but it's the same. Achieve the same input-output and the same complexity, more or less. Okay, so there is a way to learn the heavy Fourier coefficient of a function over Zn. So now what's the rest of the topic in the next 10 minutes? In some sense, it's unfair, because now I'm going to tell you the connection between codes and Fourier analysis, which I already just spent two slides on. And then we'll talk about what are the special properties of our codes. So the first bullet is that there is some... One can talk about Fourier analysis with respect to codes, okay? Not only our codes. But in particular, our codes, okay, have some nice properties in terms of Fourier representation, and that's what I'll spend the rest of my time on. Okay, so this is useful for some, not useful for others, whoops, but I will go through it. Okay, so in general, we want to sort of identify a Boolean function, because we have these Boolean functions here with some, you know, complex vector. So we want to look at the function as its value at 0, 1, 2, and so forth, up to n minus 1. And all the time so far I've been talking about this function as being Boolean, having zeros and ones. Let's just think it's actually ones and minus ones. So a 0 will write a 1, a 1 will write a minus 1. Okay, so the standard basis is just the unit vectors, but instead since we're interested in Fourier analysis, we'll talk about the character basis. So I guess the primitive root of unity, and this will be the basis we discuss. And then we can actually think of the function, the original function that we have in our hands, our f or g, as essentially the sum of the Fourier coefficients at alpha times chi of alpha for all the alpha going from 1, 2, up to big N. Okay, so from now on, this is how I want to think of representing my functions, okay? And the primary interest I'm going to have is going to be the weight of these coefficients. So when I've been talking about heavy Fourier coefficients versus light, I mean when this quantity is big or small. Okay? Yeah. Why? Zn. Okay, because my code... No, that's a very good question. Because the code that I defined was, okay, J... I said the following... if I want to encode x, okay, then the jth location is going to look like j times x mod n. Okay? It's going to be the predicate at the jth location. Okay? So my index is, my index j is essentially a number mod n. So I'm taking it in 1, j equal to 1, to 2, to 3, all the way to big N. And then the value is a bit, because the predicate gives me a bit. That's why I'm over the n. So now what do I have? I have a function now. So my function then is a function that goes from So my function goes from z n to 0, 1. Right? So it's going from j to the value of the bit.
Well, one of the functions you're talking about is defined on zn.
Yeah, but now I don't care about the one function. I just care about the code. And the code, the way it's defined is that in every element of zn has to have a bit value. How binary? So my box, okay, my magic box is expecting numbers, as Andy is saying. My magic box is expecting elements in Zn, wherever big N means. It could be for R, say, Zn star, or, I mean, Z little n, or for exponentiation Z sub t minus 1. So that's what my magic box is expecting. You're saying maybe there's a way to feed the magic box just things that are always perfect powers of 2 and still take advantage of it. But I don't know how to do that. I mean, the whole thing would be thrown off. I have no idea how to do that. I think that was the first thing we were trying because we didn't have a learning algorithm. We weren't aware those guys developed it. But we couldn't do that. Okay. So far I just said some words about Fourier analysis. What about codes? So essentially we want to say that what's a code? A code is a collection of code words, okay? And we were saying we want to think of this collection of code words as a bunch of functions. So this is just what you were asking, where each function is from zn to 1 and minus 1. Okay. And in particular, we want to essentially talk about the Fourier representation of these functions. And what we're going to want for this Fourier representation is we want it to be concentrated, which I have to define, and recoverable. So I want two properties from these functions. They will be concentrated and recoverable. So I have to define what concentrated and recoverable means. And in fact, for the segment predicates, the codes will be concentrated and recoverable. Not every code is, but these are. So what do we mean by concentrated? And this is actually a central concept here. Okay, so we say that a code is a concentrated code if when you look at the words in the code, this function, the function corresponding to the words, then the following is true. If you could really look at the full representation, so see what the weight is on every single character for the entire basis. But I'm claiming that for these codes, you actually don't need to look everywhere. That these are concentrated codes, meaning that if I just restrict myself to look at coefficients in a small set, this tau set, okay, and everywhere else just ignore, make it zero, then it's still going to be the case that it's a very good approximation for the function. So the difference from the original function, okay, defined everywhere on all the characters, versus the function just restricted to the smaller subset of characters. Okay, so the difference between these is small. So a concentrated function means that for every epsilon, there exists some tau of polynomial in log n of epsilon size, such that the difference between, you restrict to these characters, still this is a pretty good approximation to the original function. It agrees except for epsilon weight. Okay, so again, concentrated just means that there is actually only a polynomial number of sort of heavy coefficients, okay, where heavy is going to be defined with respect to some threshold. Okay, some functions are not this way. If you think about the Hadamard function, it is this way. If you think about the Hadamard code and you look at the code words, okay, then they're actually concentrated functions. In fact, I think they're concentrated on one character. So our functions aren't going to be concentrated on one character, but still on a small set of characters. Okay. Now, what's the main theorem that we have to prove here is the following. It's saying, okay, let's restrict ourselves to just the heavy, the characters of heavy weight. Heavy meaning greater than little tau, some threshold. Then I claim, and this is really going to be the central proposition, is that if the code were to begin was concentrated, so you could approximate it by a small subset, and W is close to CX, so it's that corrupted version, W, of the legal code word, then there exists essentially, if you look at the intersection of the heavy characters of CX and the heavy characters of W, okay, and the intersection is non-empty. Remember that we had that graph with a picture of the graph of CX, the graph of W, and we said that there's one heavy coefficient, and I'm saying that that's going to be the case for any concentrated code. Okay? As long, of course, that they agree. So we have that half, this is the same as the half plus epsilon condition. Just when you represent it in terms of 1s and minus 1, just means that this inner product of these functions is greater than epsilon. So again, if you want a picture, if this is a concentrated code word, and that's its corruption, there will be some... If you look at all the heavy coefficients of a black line and all the heavy coefficients of a green line, one of them will lie in an intersection. It doesn't tell me that one can find it, but it tells me at least that now, if I was just given a corruption, a corrupted version, and I were able to find all the heavy coefficients of the corrupted version, one of them is actually also a heavy coefficient of the real code word. I don't know which one. Okay, but one of them is. And since it's just a small, the set of heavy characters is small, it's polynomial size, I can work one by one with each one of them. And say, let's assume that this is the one in common with my true code word, okay? So in fact, what the algorithm would look like, actually I need one more step, but before we, what the algorithm would look like is somehow I'll be able to recover all the heavy coefficients of the black line, okay? And now I know that one of them is good, but how do I know which one? Okay, so that's also something we need to answer. So the answer for that is that... That's true, but I need to know what I have a coefficient in my hands, right? So I know I have values of alpha, which are heavy, right? So I have chi alpha, for which the coefficient is heavy. So in fact, I have a list of alphas, but I don't have a list of x's. So that's where I need this next condition, saying that if I have a character, I can actually find an x for which this character is also heavy. So I have a list of characters, okay? And now somehow I want to go to a list of x's. What I do is I go character by character and find all the x's that if you looked at their code word, one of its heavy coefficients will be in common with, will be this one. But you can't just go through all possible x's. You need some algorithm, okay, that will able to, in polynomial time, go from a heavy coefficient to an x. Okay, so you need what we call a recovery algorithm. So putting it together, we say the following, that if the code is constrained and recoverable, so there is a way somehow to find the heavy coefficients because there's a few of them and therefore each one is heavy. If it's concentrated, meaning that there is a small subset of heavy coefficients, okay? And also from these coefficients, I can go back to x that has a coefficient like, which is the same coefficient as a heavy also for x, then the original code was misdecodable. And these would be the steps of the algorithm. I would start with the corrupted code word and some parameter. I first would find the heavy coefficients of W. Then, by using the recovery algorithm, this would be the learning algorithm. Then, by using the recovery algorithm, I will return all the Y's, such that if you look at the heavy of the code word of Y intersected with the list, it's non-empty. Okay? And then we would be done. Any question? Probably those who followed up to now don't have a question. Yeah.
Don't we also have to know that there are only polynomially many heavy coefficients for W? Is W necessarily concentrated?
That's a good point. It is concentrated, but I'm trying to think if there's something that I said already would imply that. Let's put it this way. From this proposition of concentration and agreement, I'm saying if the corruption is just by half minus epsilon, okay, that proposition says that there will be a heavy one in common. Okay. So you're saying, no, that's not enough. Because then...
Might there not be lots of other heavy ones in W that you have to
then consider in the algorithm? Yeah, you would have to explicitly prove that.
Isn't that part of the definition of the algorithm?
No, but no, he's talking about W itself being by itself a concentrated function. That's a good point. I have to think about it, okay? I mean, it's okay. At least for the second predicate, it's okay. But Okay, that's a good point. I have to think about it. Excuse me? No, but if the function was concentrated, then the learning algorithm will find you these heavy coefficients quickly. So in other words, what Andy's saying, maybe this W is not concentrated. So I'm going to find... oh, no, that's okay. I have to think about it. Okay, sorry, I have to think about it. I can't answer it. I have to think about it. Okay. All right, so finally we come to our segment predicates. And essentially we have to show that they are concentrated and recoverable. So everything that I spoke so far was if we had a code that was concentrated and recoverable, then we would have a list decoding algorithm. Okay, but in particular, what about our codes? And the answer is that, in fact, you can show that for these particular codes, they are both concentrated and recoverable. And therefore, we would be done. But the codes we define are list decodable, we can apply the whole list decoding approach for the hardcore predicates. Now, you can say similar things about unbalanced predicates, but I'm going to sort of skip that. Again, an unbalanced predicate would be something that's not 50 half times 0 half times 1. So when you talk about a prediction box, it's not predicting better than 50-50, but you want to say that it's predicting better than, let's say if it's 3/4 of a time 1 and 1/4 of a time 0, it should do, the prediction should be better than the obvious. So it should be sort of 3/4 plus epsilon. Okay, so we're saying if we have such a prediction box, then we can, again, have a similar, we can show that that's hardcore with the right definition, not of half plus epsilon, but 3/4 plus epsilon. So what's the conclusion? The conclusion is that I need to think of what you asked, but the conclusion is that we have new proofs here for known hardcore predicates. It gives us some new hardcore predicates, and you know, the approach is unifying. And sort of the bigger conclusion is that we're able to make this list decoding approach work for deterministic hardcore predicates, not just for the randomized one from Goldreich-Levin. And in terms of the future, you know, an interesting question here is, can you look for more? In general, these days, you know, people have a code and then they design a list decoding algorithm for it. Each code has a different list decoding algorithm. Here, there's some, you know, some general criteria for getting a list decoding algorithm, and that is that the code's words are both concentrated and recoverable. So possibly, you could look for applying this algorithm for known codes or design new codes for which this algorithm works. In fact, there's some work of Akavya on perturbation codes where she uses. I mentioned that, which uses this approach. In fact, another interesting question is to ask whether you can characterize all list decodable codes in terms of Fourier analysis. So I haven't done that. We haven't done that. But I'm just saying it's an interesting question to ask. Can you give a condition on the Fourier representation of a code which would immediately imply, you know, list decoding algorithm? Okay, and similar questions that people ask these days about codes, like not only list decoding, but people ask whether a code is testable. So is it, how do you have an efficient algorithm to tell that something is close to a code word? People talk about local decoding. So there's various questions in coding theory, in algorithmic coding theory, that possibly you could, you know, use Fourier representation to answer. And I guess this slide is sort of an obvious slide that Fourier analysis seems to be useful for cryptography, both in this talk and this work of Regev about lattice-based cryptosystems, and there might be more applications. So it seems to be a very useful tool to get results either that we knew already. In fact, usually it's results we already knew. So it's not that somehow by looking at Fourier analysis you get new questions or you can solve something that was open before, but more, you know, taking what people have managed to solve with traditional tools and going somewhat further. Okay, thank you. I'm out of time.